Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Welcome back to Evening Under Lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, here on Cambridge 105 Radio. Last time, you'll remember, as part of the Halloween show, we attended to two Scottish ballads, Tam Lin and Thomas the Rhymer. I thought I'd take up from there and spend this show, and probably the next as well, looking at ballads of all different sorts. I think you'll enjoy the variety of selections we have lined up this evening under lamplight. And of course, you are invited to attend. And first, to remind us where we are, let's hear again Alec Guinness reading from T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. The aim, I think, is for us to keep hearing these lines, picking up one little bit this time, another little bit another time, and maybe finally having some of these lines or some of these phrases resonating in our oral imagination to come back to us at appropriate times. It's only a very short passage, so we can, I hope, bear to hear it each time. Here it is. Home is where one starts from.
Home is where one starts from. As we grow older, the world becomes stranger, the pattern more complicated of dead and living. Not the intense moment isolated with no before and after, but a lifetime burning in every moment, and not the lifetime of one man only, but of old stones that cannot be deciphered. There is a time for the evening under starlight, a time for the evening under lamplight, the evening with the photograph album. Love is most nearly itself when here and now cease to matter. Old men ought to be explorers. Here and there does not matter. We must be still and still moving into another intensity for a further union, a deeper communion through the dark cold and the empty desolation, the wave cry, the wind cry, the vast waters of the petrel and the porpoise. In my end is my beginning.
Home is where one starts from, which suggests, doesn't it, that home is the place we have to leave. Maybe we'll come back again, home again, maybe not. Thomas Wolfe titled his final novel, You Can't Go Home Again. But Dylan sees it a little more hopefully as he sings in the song Mississippi, you can always come back, but you can't come back all the way. And that's sort of the theme of the first ballad we'll look at. It's called The Wife of Usher's Well, one of the more powerful of the Scottish ballads, all the more powerful for its brevity and its sparseness of explanatory details. And the main action takes place in the season of Martinmas, which is the season we're just entering now, St. Martin's Day being November 11th. The plot of this ballad is pretty simple. There lived a wife at Usher's Well, we're told at the beginning, and a wealthy wife was she. She had three stout and stalwart sons and sent them o'er the sea. Why did she send her sons to sea? We don't know. It doesn't really matter. They left home. Home was where they started from. We don't know what happened to them after they left home, but we're told that word came to the Carlin wife, the old woman, that her three sons were dead. She utters a fierce curse. May strong winds arise and the seas churn furiously until my three sons come back to me in earthly flesh and blood. And that's the end of the first act. Then, when it fell aboot the Martinmas, when nights are lang and mirk, long and dark, that the three sons did return. They can go home again, but they can't come home all the way. There's one strange detail about them. Their hats were o' the birk. That is, their hats were made of birch wood. Now, that may seem odd, but in fact, I have a hat made of wood, or not quite wood itself, but the bark of a tree. I don't know which tree, but the hat was made in Uganda. They apparently pound the bark into a mash, which then becomes pliant like cloth, and then they mould it into a hat. And a bonny hat it is, even after 7 years of use, a little floppier than it was at first, but a good friend, and thanks to Emily who bought it for me. Sorry, that was a wee diversion. The three sons' hats were made of birch, a sacred tree associated with death. And in fact, the tree their hats came from was very special. It didn't grow in any of your ordinary spots, not in Syke, nor Ditch, nor yet in Onesuch, not by a stream or a ditch or a trench, but at the gates o' paradise. That's where they get their clothes now, it seems. St. Peter's finest men's wear, or something like that. In other words, they are dead indeed. And perhaps more important, they're not damned, but in heaven, or at least at the gates of heaven. Maybe they can't enter inside the gates until they carry out this last mission to their mother. The mother, though, apparently thinks her sons have come home alive, and she prepares a feast for her sons and a bed for them, and, here's a touching image, she wraps herself in her mantle and sits by their bedside all night, so pleased to have them back. And maybe just waiting there, knowing they might try to leave again, or maybe knowing that their visit is only for this night. We never really know what goes on inside the minds and hearts of people in the Scottish ballads. But the cock crows at dawn, and the brothers must leave. They'll be punished if they're missed. Missed by whom? Are they in the grave or by the gates of paradise? Don't ask. Now, you know the plot, but the emotional intensity comes from the speeches, especially at the end, which leaves so much open to our interpretation. Here's C.R.M. Brooks reciting the ballad, perhaps milking it a little too much, but I don't think he violates the words and the meter, which is what counts. And after that, we'll hear it sung in a traditional way by Heather Haywood.
There lived a waif at Usher's Well, and a wealthy wife was she. She had three stout and stalwart sons, and sent them o'er the sea. They hadna been a week frae her, a week but barely ane, and word came to the Carlin wife that her three sons were gane. They hadna been a week frae her, a week but barely three, when word came to the Carlin wife that her sons she'd never see. Oh, if the wind may never cease, nor flashes in the flood, till my three sons come home to me in earthly flesh and blood. It fell about the Martinmas, when nechts are lang and mirk, the Carlin wife's three sons come home, but their hats were o' the birk. It grew in neither Syke nor Ditch, nor yet in Onesuch. But at the gates of paradise, that birk grew fair anew. Blow up the fire, my maidens, bring water for the well, for all my house'll feast this night, since my three sons are well. And she has made to them a bed, she's made it large and wide, and she stained her mantle, her a boot, sat doon at the bedside. Up then crew the red, red cork, and up and crew the grey. The eldest to the youngest said, 'Tis time we were away. The cork he hadna crowed but ance, and clapped his wings at awe, when the youngest to the eldest said, 'Brother, we must awa'. The cork doth crow, the day doth daw, the channern worm doth chite. Can we be missed out o' our place, a sair pain we maun bite? Fare ye weel, my mother dear, fare weel to barn and by. And fare ye weel, the bonny lass that kennels my mother's fire.'
There lived a wife at Usher's Well, and a wealthy wife was she. She had three stout and stalwart sons, and she sent them to the sea. Now they had na been but a week frae her, a week and barely in, when words come back to the Carlin wife that her three sons were gane. Now they had na been but a week frae her, a week and barely three, when words come back to the Carlin wife that her son she would never see. I wish the wind would never blow, nor fashes in the flood, till my three sons come home to me in earthly flesh and blood. Now it fell about the Martinmas, when the nicks were long in mark, that the Carlin wife's three sons come home, and their hearts were o' the bark. That bark grew nocht in ony ditch, nor yet in ony shock, but at the gates o' paradise, that bark grew fair enough. Mend up the fire, my maidens, draw water frae the well, for o' this house shall feast the nicht, since my three sons are well. And she has made for them a bed, she has made it long and wide. She's put her mantle, her about, sat down by their bedside. Then up and crew the red, red cock, and up and crew the grey, and the eldest to the youngest said, "Oh, it's time that we were away." Oh, the cock it had nae crawed but audience, not flapped its wings at all. When the eldest to the youngest said, "Aye, it's time that we were a war. For the cock doth crow, the day doth dawn, the chamberin worm doth chide, and gin we be mistook our place, a sair fate we maun bide. Say fare ye weel, my mother, fare weel to burn and bier, and fare thee weel, the bonny lass that kindles my mother's fire."
That was the ballad "The Wife of Usher's Well," read by C.R.M. Brooks and sung by Heather Haywood. You have to forego your craving for steady, bounding, uplifting beat and just let this song wash over you and repeat itself over and over, a kind of a hypnotic daze with the storyline running at the same time along with you. And what an intriguing ending. Why does this youngest son give his last lingering farewell to the bonny lass that kindles my mother's fire? Had he fallen in love with her? Is she going to be more heartbroken than even the mother? We never even see her, but here she comes, a centre of emotional intensity, just at the end, to appear and disappear. Perhaps a ghost herself, as far as the poem is concerned. But it occurs to me, the mother didn't send the boys off to sea in order to cure this youngest of his infatuation with a kitchen maid, did she? Well, now, to show how powerful these traditional ballads are with their sparse use of detail and dependence on snatches of dramatic incident to give them strength, here's a contrast. A pretty silly ballad, entirely in narrative. It's a piece of American mythology, and in fact, a lot of national, not to say nationalistic, mythology is spread through ballads, often bad ballads, oversimplifying the past in order to create the kind of legendary heroes people want to idolize. And I offer, for our consideration, the Ballad of Davy Crockett, a song my whole generation in America grew up singing. How far its white American ideology survived with us through the late 60s and 70s is debatable. The ballad distorts the real life of Davy Crockett, as ballads are allowed to do, giving the impression that he fought single-handed in the Indian War till the Creeks was whipped and the peace restored. Well, not quite. Yes, Davy Crockett enlisted for two limited periods in military units during the Creek Wars of 1813 and 14, but rather than actually going out to kill the Creeks, Davy Crockett was more active just as a scout, and especially as a hunter, providing food for the troops. The idea that the Creeks were whipped, we're supposed to cheer at this point, and the peace restored, well, you can guess on whose terms the peace was restored. But the myth has to show this white American hero taking full charge of beating the Redskins. And yet, the next verse of the song seems accurate. He gave his word and he gave his hand that this Injun friends could keep their land. The rest of his life he took the stand that justice was due every Redskin man. That's a four times rhyme of hand, land, stand, and sort of man. This really emphasizes the point that what a great guy he was. And it's true that when Davy Crockett served in the U.S. House of Representatives, he consistently opposed any attempt to expel the native tribes from their ancestral lands, vehemently opposing Andrew Jackson's Indian Removal Act, the only Tennessee congressman to oppose it. And both in the U.S. Congress and earlier in the Tennessee General Assembly, Crockett promoted measures to support the poor settlers and farmers who were often in danger of losing everything because of the complex land grant systems. So, yes, a real hero for the underdog, though in 1955, I don't think the American myth had room for that. The American hero had to be on the side of the winners, finding his greatest moments as the lone adventurer heading out into the West, the God-given land of plenty. Plenty of myths, for instance. His land is biggest and his land is best, from grassy plains to the mountain crest. He's ahead of us all and meeting the test, following his legend into the West. Stirring stuff. And that's how the ballad ends, echoing his epithet, King of the Wild Frontier. But wait, you forgot something. What happened to the episode at the Alamo? Well, Davy was on the losing side there, so maybe the ballad wants to overlook this. Actually, when Davy Crockett was voted out of Congress, he couldn't stand up against the rampant popularism of Andrew Jackson. He left and went to Texas, where the American settlers were fighting a war of independence against Mexico. He's reported to have said, "I told the people of my district that I would serve them as faithfully as I had done, but if they didn't want me, they might go to hell, and I would go to Texas." Why to Texas? Perhaps this was another fight on behalf of the underdog, but perhaps there were other reasons. Crockett, all along, was very good at self-promotion. In 1834, for instance, he brought out the Narrative of the Life of Davy Crockett of the State of Tennessee, written by himself, with his motto on the title page, "I leave this rule for others when I'm dead. Be sure you're right, then go ahead." And my friend John Nolan, the guy I go to for the straight dope about American history, suggests this. Crockett, in my view, probably went to Texas in order to build on his fame as a frontiersman before another congressional bid. That is sort of a PR thing. All right, that makes sense. It doesn't make him insincere, just canny. In any case, there he was, in Texas, at a volatile time, and found himself at the Alamo, a small mission compound in San Antonio, about to be besieged by an enormous Mexican army under Santa Anna. After a 90-minute battle, Davy and all the others defending the compound were dead, but mythic history was made. In the Walt Disney miniseries out of which the Ballad of Davy Crockett comes, the final scene at the Alamo shows the compound overrun by the Mexican soldiers. And there's Davy Crockett, weary but intrepidly swinging away with the heavy end of his rifle, and just as the soldiers close in on him, the action freezes and fades as the Ballad of Davy Crockett comes in, trailing clouds of glory. I've just been watching this on YouTube, and actually it's a very stirring moment, so let's not be too cynical. Let's not be too analytical either, and let's get on with the ballad itself. There were many versions, all becoming hits in the mid-50s. We'll hear the version with Fess Parker, the guy who played Davy Crockett in the Disney version. Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee, the greenest state in the land of the free.
Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee, greenest state in the land of the free. Raised in the woods so he knew every tree. Killed him a bar when he was only three. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. Fought single-handed through the Indian war till the Creeks was whipped and the peace was in store. While he was handling this risky chore, made himself a legend forevermore. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. Give his word and he give his hand that his Indian friends could keep their land. The rest of his life he took the stand that justice was due every redskin band. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. He went off to Congress and served a spell, fixing up the government and laws as well. Took over Washington, so we hear tell, and patched up the crack in the Liberty Bell. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. When he come home, his politicking done, the Western march had just begun. So he packed his gear and his trusty gun, and lit out grinning to follow the sun. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. His land is biggest and his land is best, from grassy plains to the mountain crest. He's ahead of us all, meeting the test, following his legend into the west. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. King of the wild frontier.
That was Fess Parker giving us his version of the Ballad of Davy Crockett, continuing the self-promotion that Crockett started back in the 1830s. An American myth, the hero who is close to nature. He knew every tree, for instance, and even at age 3, he knew how to kill a bear, and was able to do it, too. A hero who steps up, takes charge, and sorts out any problem. A hero who ventures out alone, facing all challenges intrepidly, leaving this rule for others when he's dead. Be sure you're right, then go ahead. And in the ballad, rhyming 2 lines out of 4 in every stanza isn't enough here. All 4 lines in the stanza have to rhyme. That's a hero's treatment. Now we'll move ahead to another mythic ballad about the American West. The loner, the guy who wanders around from place to place. A tough guy, always ready for a fight. This mythic image still exists, and many American men, perhaps many men all over the world, buy into it. But here's a ballad that gives us a different point of view about this myth. An attractive, bouncy rhythm, Johnny Cash's endearing voice, and lots of clever rhymes. And it's funny, too, of course. A Boy Named Sue.
Well, my daddy left home when I was 3, and he didn't leave much to Ma and me, just this old guitar and an empty bottle of booze. Now, I don't blame him because he run and hid, but the meanest thing that he ever did was before he left, he went and named me Sue. Well, he must have thought that it was quite a joke, and it got a lot of laughs from lots of folks. Seems I had to fight my whole life through. Some gal would giggle and I'd get red, and some guy'd laugh and I'd bust his head. I'll tell you, life ain't easy for a boy named Sue. Well, I grew up quick and I grew up mean. My fists got hard, my wits got keen. Roamed from town to town to hide my shame. But I made me a vow to the moon and stars, I'd search the honky-tonks and bars and kill that man that gave me that awful name. Well, it was Gatlinburg in mid-July, and I'd just hit town and my throat was dry. I thought I'd stop and have myself a groove. At an old saloon on a street of mud, there at a table, dealing stud, sat a dirty, mangy dog that named me Sue. Well, I knew that snake was my own sweet dad from a worn-out picture that my mother'd had, and I knew that scar on his cheek and his evil eye. He was big and bent and gray and old, and I looked at him and my blood ran cold, and I said, my name is Sue, how do you do? How are you gonna die? Yeah, that's what I told him. Well, I hit him hard right between the eyes, and he went down, but to my surprise, come up with a knife and cut off a piece of my ear. But I busted a chair right across his teeth, and we crashed through the wall and into the street, kicking and a-gouging in the mud and the blood and the beard. I tell you, I've fought tougher men, but I really can't remember when. He kicked like a mule and he bit like a crocodile. I heard him laugh and then I heard him cuss, and he went for his gun and I pulled mine first. He stood there looking at me and I saw him smile. And he said, son, this world is rough, and if a man's gonna make it, he's gotta be tough. And I know I wouldn't be there to help you along. So I give you that name and I said goodbye. I knew you'd have to get tough or die. And it's that name that helped to make you strong. Yeah. He said, now you just fought one hell of a fight, and I know you hate me and you got the right to kill me now, and I wouldn't blame you if you do. But you ought to thank me before I die for the gravel in your guts and the spit in the eye, cause I'm the that named you Sue. What could I do? I got all choked up and I threw down my gun, called him a paw and he called me a son, and I come away with a different point of view. And I think about him now and then, every time I try and every time I win. And if I ever have a son, I think I'm gonna name him Bill or George, anything but Sue. I still ain't that man.
Johnny Cash, A Boy Named Sue, a silly song, but always entertaining. What's the moral? This is a world where a man has to fight to prove he's a man. Otherwise, he's just a sissy and deserves to be called by a girl's name. And if he can fight tough, then he can rise above any kind of effeminacy people might see in him. Might makes right. Much foreign policy is based on this, as you know. But not us here at Evening Under Lamplight, where we try to be quietly right. No tests of strength around here. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and you're listening to us on Cambridge 105 Radio. This Evening Under Lamplight, I'm inviting you to attend with me to various ballads. We'll continue in a few seconds, but first here's Neil Henry, awkwardly remastered for our new branding.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105 Radio.
Thank you. Now, I'd like to take us over to some ballads by Bob Dylan. We'll probably be featuring him in each of our shows about ballads, but here this evening are two ballads continuing our theme of this mythic Western hero. First, here's a story about another one of those men wandering alone. Many of the old Scottish ballads tell the story of some man from another place, perhaps from the Highlands, or a gypsy, or from a rival clan, coming in and stealing away someone's daughter or wife, or else it's the daughter or wife who willingly escapes from home with that attractive outsider. In this song, Man in a Long Black Coat from the Oh Mercy album, we know almost nothing but the bare outlines of the story. All we know is that she's gone with the man in the long black coat, the refrain repeated at each stanza. The song begins not with the story, but with four lines setting some kind of scene for us, or at least some atmosphere. Just attend to the feelings this description evokes. Crickets are chirping, the water is high, there's a soft cotton dress on the line hanging dry. Window wide open, African trees bent over backwards from a hurricane breeze. And then the barest sketch of the plot. Not a word of goodbye, not even a note. She's gone with the man in the long black coat. Then all we get are second-hand accounts of this man, and then a shift to what the preacher was talking about. Maybe what we learn most about the situation comes, as it often does, from the sound rather than the sense. Dylan's a master at setting himself a refrain line that he has to find a rhyme for over and over. And as Chip in Charlottesville points out, almost all of these rhyming words have something to do with language or speech. Note, quote, throat, rote. Are we reminded here that this is just a story? Just something Dylan wrote and now sings in his throat and I've just quoted from? One more note about this large mythic hero? Well, here, jump into the story. It's haunting.
Thank you. crickets are chirping, the water is high. There's a soft cotton dress on the line, hanging dry. The windows wide open, African trees bent over backwards from a hurricane breeze. Not a word of goodbye, not even a note. She gone with a man in a long black coat. Somebody seen him hanging around at the old dance hall on the outskirts of town. He looked into her eyes when she stopped him to ask if he wanted to dance. He had a face like a mask. Somebody said from the Bible he'd quote, there was dust on the man in the long black coat. There's a sermon he gave. He said every man's conscience is vile and depraved. You cannot depend on it to be your guide when it's you who must keep it satisfied. It ain't easy to swallow. It sticks in the throat to give her heart to the man in a long black coat. There are no mistakes in life, some people say, and it's true sometimes, you can see it that way. But people don't live or die, people just float. She went with the man in a long black coat. There's smoke on the water, it's up in there since June. Tree trunks uprooted beneath the high crescent moon. Feel the pulse and vibration and the rumbling force. Somebody is out there beating on a dead horse. She never said nothing, there was nothing she wrote. She'd gone with a man in a long black coat.
Well, I said it was haunting. And there's this odd presentation. Can we really call it singing? It's more like thrusting out each half line as though perhaps trying to hold back, the emotions lying far behind the words. Now, it's not really part of the ballad convention to insert general comments about life, but Dylan does it here, or maybe it's just what the preacher had been saying. But it's memorable. There are no mistakes in life, some people say. It's true sometimes you can see it that way, but people don't live or die, people just float. She went with the man in the long black coat. What's that suggest? Did she, whoever she is, wife or daughter, did she just float off with the man? Is that how it happens? Is life so tenuous that people live in some in-between state, neither living nor dying? Dante's pusillanimi in limbo? And they just float off, surrendering to any pull that comes along? Or is that the way life is in this kind of environment, a sultry southern world that just seems to lie inert? There's smoke on the water. It's been there since June. Tree trunks uprooted neath the high crescent moon. Feel the pulse and vibration and the rumbling force. Somebody's out there beating on a dead horse. She never said nothing. There was nothing she wrote. She's gone with the man in the long black coat. But talking about someone just floating off with an outsider who comes to town reminds me to move next to a longer Dylan ballad, Brownsville Girl, from the 1986 album Knocked Out Loaded. If traditional ballads are sparse in explanations, then this song seems to fit in well. It's long and rambling, jumping from various scenes, but over it all lies the feel of that Western starring Gregory Peck, more tough men contending with the world. The album never got much attention, but Brownsville Girl is an obvious hit, giving life to the whole album. Robert Christgau called the song one of the greatest and most ridiculous of Dylan's great ridiculous epics. It's a mysterious ballad because we're never really sure what's going on or where we are. There are three threads, or maybe more, running through the ballad. First, the movie starring Gregory Peck, which the speaker seems at one point to be drawn into and finds himself taking part in the action of it. And then another Gregory Peck movie. He's got a new one out now. I don't even know what it's about, he says. But I'll see him in anything, so I'll stand in line. So he's an observer now, not one of the actors. The second thread is the Brownsville girl. We're back in Texas again, you see. With her Brownsville curls and teeth like pearls, shining like the moon above. Showing him all around the world, his honey love, some woman he at some point traveled around with, driving the busted down Ford out west till the wheels came off, spending the night, coincidentally enough for our show, spending the night just outside the Alamo. But he's no longer with her, and the woman he's with only sort of reminds him of her with that dark rhythm in her soul. And the third thread, somehow intertwined, is the little picture of Ruby living with Henry Porter in a wrecking lot just outside of town. Henry's not there, and Ruby's just going through the mindless motions, in the backyard hanging clothes, presumably something other than the soft cotton dress on the line hanging dry that the woman in the other song left behind when she went off with the man in the long black coat. And there's Ruby with her red hair tied back, presumably not even caring about her looks. She told us how times were tough and about how she was thinking of bumming a ride back to from where she started. But, you know, she changed the subject every time money came up. She said, "Welcome to the land of the living dead." You could tell she was so broken-hearted. She said even the swap meets around here are getting pretty corrupt. So, no, she's too broken to go off with any man in the long black coat or otherwise. And round these threads go, in ways we certainly have no time this evening to address. But this ballad is not really a song, since, although there is music and a sassy backup chorus, Dylan just speaks the words. There is the ballad four-line stanza with the second and fourth lines rhyming. Ballads always highlight the rhymes. But there seems to be no meter. Dylan wrote this song along with Sam Shepard. And I remember reading, though I can't find it again now, I remember reading that Shepard objected to some of the lines, which he felt were much too long to fit in. "Don't worry about that," Dylan told him. "That's my business." And look out for one of my favorite Dylan lines. "The only thing we knew for sure about Henry Porter is that his name wasn't Henry Porter." We all give ourselves labels, but we know that the labels are not true. Just the name, perhaps, of the character we're playing in some movie. "The only thing we knew for sure about Henry Porter is that his name wasn't Henry Porter." That seems to sum up the ballad. The only thing we're clear about is that this ballad is not clear. Here, jump into it. It's long, 11 minutes long, and worth it.
"Well, there was this movie I seen one time. about a man riding across the desert, and it starred Gregory Peck. He was shot down by a hungry kid trying to make a name for himself. The townspeople wanted to crush that kid down and string him up by the neck. Well, the marshal, now he beat that kid to a bloody pulp. As the dying gunfighter lay on the sun and gasped for his last breath, turn him loose, let him go, let him say he outdrew me, fair and square. I want him to feel what it's like to every moment face his death. Well, I keep seeing this stuff, and it just comes a-rolling in. And you know it blows right through me like a ball and chain. You know, I can't believe we've lived so long, and I'm still so far apart. The memory of you keeps calling after me like a rolling train. I can still see the day you came to me on a painted desert. In your busted down Ford and your platform heels, I could never figure out why you chose that particular place to meet. Oh, but you were right, it was perfect as I got in behind the wheel. Well, we drove that car all night until we got into San Antonio, and we slept near the Alamo. Your so tender and soft. Way down in Mexico, you went out to find a doctor and you never came back. I would have gone on after you, but I didn't feel like letting my head get blown off. Well, we're driving this car and the sun is coming up over the Rockies. Now I know she ain't you, but she's here and she's got that dark rhythm in her soul. But I'm too over the edge and ain't in the mood anymore to remember the times when I was your only man. And she don't wanna remind me, she knows this car would go out of control. He owned a wrecking lot outside of town about a mile. Ruby was in the backyard hanging clothes. She had her red hair tied back. She saw us come rolling up in a trail of dust. She says, Henry ain't here, but you can come on in. He'll be back in a little while. Then she told us how times were tough and about how she was thinking of bumming a ride back to from where she started. But she changed the subject every time money came up. She said, welcome to the land of the living dead. But you can tell she was so brokenhearted. She said, even the swap meets around here are getting pretty corrupt. How far are you all going? Ruby asked us with a sigh. We're going all the way till the wheels fall off and burn. Till the sun peels the paint and the seat covers fade. Ruby just smiled and said, oh, you know some babies never learn. Something about that movie, though, that I just can't get it out of my head. But I can't remember why I was in it or what part I was supposed to play. All I remember about it was is Gregory Peck and the way that people move. And a lot of them, they seem to be looking my way.
somebody with a pompadour. I was crossing the street when shots rang out. I didn't know whether to duck or to run, so I ran. We got him cornered in the churchyard. I heard somebody shout. Well, you saw my picture in the Corpus Christi Tribune. Underneath it, it said a man with no alibi. You went out on a limb to testify for me. You said I was with you. Then when I saw you break down in front of the judge and cry real tears, it was the best acting I saw anybody do. Now, I've always been the kind of person that doesn't like to trespass, but sometimes you just find yourself over the line. Oh, if there's an original thought out there, I could use it right now. You know, I feel pretty good, but that ain't saying much. I could feel a whole lot better if you were just here by my side to show me how. Well, I'm standing in line in the rain to see a movie starring Gregory Peck. Yeah, but you know it's not the one that I had in mind. He's got a new one out now. I don't even know what it's about, but I'll see him in anything, so I'll stand in line.
That was Brownsville Girl from Dylan's Knocked Out Loaded album. And this has been Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, hoping you'll come back next time for more balladry of various kinds. Reach me with comments or suggestions or requests at lamplight@cambridge105.co.uk and find the archives at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk. And now, good night.